the right voltage, E field, and the right strength of magnetic field. So for the particular desirable mode of operation, if you look at the so-called Reiki diagrams for magnetrons, and I'm trying to remember what book was that in, but you start Googling the word magnetron, and there's something called Reiki diagram where you look at a graph that shows you all the possible magnetic fields, all the possible voltages, and it plots for you all the possible power outputs. It looks a little bit like a Smith chart. And you'll find out that there's two or three different modes of operation of the tube, but only one of them is really desirable. And that desirable mode, where it gives you reasonably high efficiency, is a very specific voltage, current, and magnetic field. And you make much of a disturbance of any of those, and the thing will just say, I don't feel like oscillating. The heck with you. As I said, it's a very simple circuit, but it's persnickety. You meet all of its conditions, and you'll like what it does. You start disturbing those conditions, and I think you're going to become reasonably unhappy fairly fast. Anybody have any further questions or comments on this? Give me your call. It is K2LIW in the TechNet.
But Dick, if the oscillator self-oscillates when we're not looking for the generation of heat, do we care, and is that harmful to the magnetron?
Yes, it is. Let me drop this. When you put voltage and current through that tube and it's not oscillating, all of that current goes into pure dissipation within the magnetron itself. When it oscillates correctly, it runs at something close to 90% efficiency. You're putting 850 watts in and you're getting 700 and some odd watts output as RF energy. If it doesn't oscillate correctly, and you're putting 800 watts in, instead of it dissipating 100 watts, you're asking for it to dissipate 800 watts. Guarantee you're not going to be happy with that result in the long term. So if it doesn't break into oscillation while you're spending any substantial amount of time putting voltage and current through it, and it's now got to dissipate all that energy. Here we go back to conservation of energy. I would like it to be all RF output. Without the RF, you're in trouble. Right, back to you, John.
I got a question, Dick.
Okay, Dick, give it to Mel.
Go ahead, Mel.
I, in the back of my mind, I remember something called the flywheel effect. What was that reference to that, Dick? Over.
In the case of a radar system that runs with a magnetron, you have a pulse-forming network that's going to put a beautiful pulse of, let me pick a number, 10,000 volts onto your magnetron. Your magnetron is going to produce a beautiful pulse of RF energy during the time that your 10,000 volts is present. However, on each individual pulse of 10,000 volts you put onto the tube, the tube starts up oscillating at a slightly different time, at a slightly different phase angle. You get a significant amount of jitter from pulse to pulse on a pure magnetron-fed radar. I can tell you that for sure because I know of people who worked on the circuits to look at the jitter and look at the characteristics of the pulses coming out of a radar while observing somebody else's radar. And by looking at that spectral signature, they said, aha, those guys just changed the tube. You know, when they change the tube, they know you went to do service by looking at these crazy characteristics. If you've got some kind of an idling circuit with high Q that looks at the pulse of energy coming out of the last pulse of the magnetron and stores it, and at the beginning of the next pulse, pours it back in there to tickle it just right to start it off at the right time, at the right phase angle, you're building an idler circuit, so to speak, a flywheel circuit. There's various ways that you can make sure that each time the magnetron starts up, it starts up at your period of time that you care about in the right nanosecond with the right phase angle, and now you can create a hell of a lot more coherency pulse to pulse, and depending on the exoticness of the radar receiver that's analyzing the echoes, you get a hell of a lot more desirable information out of a more coherent tube. K2KEY.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You've got it, Mel.
Okay, yes, now I recall. I couldn't remember what the heck the flywheel effect was. Yes, it was, I think, one of the questions, something I remember on one of the tests for getting the commercial license with the radar endorsement, if I remember. I think that goes back quite a number of years, Dick. Okay. Getting kind of late. You want to see, did you try to pick up Paul again? Maybe he's still with us.
Okay, let's try again. WS2N, Paul, are you there? K2RYW? There you go. Go ahead, Eric.
Just to point out while you're on the subject, one of the things that we do in our transmitters is the cathode voltage is -28,000 to -32,000 volts, and we need to be able to control grid current and grid voltage. And one of the ways we do it is, you know, the semiconductors do work fine at -28,000 volts. Of course, the problem is controlling the circuit, and we generally do it with a piece of fiber optic to give us the electrical isolation. So, you know, I've got stuff that runs at 3 volts or 27,996 volts, and, you know, it works reliably well.
That's a beautiful circuit, and I agree with you. However, fiber optic control reaching through the high voltage power supply, controlling a control grid of an exotically designed magnetron with a control grid, and doing that, all of that at the very inexpensive competitive rate at which you and I buy a microwave oven, except for a very high value market, that's not going to be an easy microwave oven to sell, in my opinion. Eric, go ahead.
Well, you know, 20 years ago maybe. Today, not so hard. Really, you know, cheap piece of fiber is, you know, 59 cents. Diode and photo detectors, you know, $3. And a cheap micro, not too expensive either. So, it can be done. Although, your price of $40 for a Maggie tube is a little bit high, considering you can buy microwave from China for $40, the entire unit, so you got to figure labor and everything else. It's going to make the tube cost a little bit less, but then again, that's partly why this country is in so much big trouble.
Question?
Go ahead, John.
I really don't want to beat this horse to death. One more question, then I want to hear you go on about what you discovered about antennas. I'm very interested in hearing that, too, before the time runs out. But how about just reducing the filament voltage? I know we can't cycle it on and off, but just crack it down maybe 30%. Would that work, that type of control?
In the case of high power tubes, you usually turn on the filament for some number of minutes before you apply the high voltage, because you want the whole cathode to come up to an even temperature so that it evenly emits. If only a little portion of the cathode is hot and other portions are cold, and yet you're forcing the tube to give you some number of amperes of beam current, you're now forcing much higher current density from those hot portions of the cathode, and that is a destructive process. It's partially destructive in the cathode. So unless you've got some pretty exotic filament circuit, lowering the filament voltage and hoping to get even heating is troublesome. Second of all, I think those Reiki diagrams will show you that if the right amount of current is not flowing through the magnetron, I don't think you get the correct trajectory of the electrons, therefore you don't get the right mode of oscillation. So once again, for the tube to really work well, he wants a very specific magnetic field, a very specific voltage, a very specific current, and a very specific load on his output connector. You've got to meet all of his conditions. You meet all of his conditions. It's a beautiful thing. You start disturbing current, voltage, magnetic field, or load, you're probably going to be unhappy with the results. He starts jumping into other modes of oscillation. It becomes very unstable. He's got a very narrow, stable region that you're looking for. That's what the Reiki diagram is telling you. I don't think you want to deviate from that very much. If you want lower power output, start off buying a smaller microwave oven. Let me drop. And maybe some of the smaller ones might even have a variable power output mode. And I am guessing one technique of getting variable power output is to have a switching circuit in the primary which skips individual cycles of the 60 cycle but always fires on zero crossing, if you know what I mean. That's one way of doing it. So firing on three-quarters of the 60 cycles, of each of those 60-cycle events, if you're firing on three-quarters of them, then you're coming close to putting three-quarters of the power output, as long as you've got a completely separate filament transformer. But as I said, I'm going to now be very curious about how my microwave oven does it. I'm going to start off by putting my oscilloscope near it, looking at the pulses of RF energy, because I've got to have a detector to do that, because I don't have a sampling scope at home that goes up to 2.5 gigs. The fastest scope I've got only goes to 300 megs. Yep. I've got to use a detector network, but I'd like to see, is the RF energy coming out of there by skipping cycles, or is it really proportional, and how are they doing it? I'm getting very curious. Anybody have any further questions or comments on this subject before we go over to the new measuring circuit? Give me a call, that is right now, K2RIW.
KC2QIQ with more information.
Hey, go ahead, Glenn.
Zulu.
And Zulu, I see Alex after Glenn. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I just was doing a little bit of research here and looking up some schematics for, you know, modern microwave ovens. And apparently what they are doing is they are using power supplies to do it. And they're using pulse width modulation on the secondary side. So in other words, it's actually controlled via the primary. I'm looking at the schematic now. And basically the frequency that they're using to average the pulse width modulation is 250 hertz. And they basically just PWM 250 hertz stick. And that's what gives them the peak average power on the tube. So they still have a low impedance on the output. Capacitance on the tube is still there, so it's still a regulated DC, but they are switching it on and off at 250 hertz with a variable pulse width, KC2QIQ.
So it sounds to me like the transformer is, let's call it a 400 hertz type transformer, a higher frequency transformer. At a 250 hertz rate, pulse width modulation is taking place, if I understand you correctly, in the primary, maybe with something like silicon-controlled switches, or silicon-controlled rectifiers, silicon-controlled switch, that in turn is modulating the pulse duration of when 4 kilovolts is present out of the power supply, or is it modulating secondary voltage that the magnetron sees? I'm a little worried now if I make much of a deviation of the voltage the magnetron sees during the time I want him to produce RF energy. He's not going to be happy if he doesn't see, let me pick a number, 4 kilovolts. So am I ending up with pulse duration modulated power to the magnetron, but whenever the power is there, it's always close to 4 kilovolts? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, interestingly enough, Dick, the circuit that I'm looking at here is a real power supply. You know, it's got a an input EMI filter, it's got an input rectifier, input regulated DC. And what they're doing there is they're doing high-frequency switching, and they're just turning the power switches, which in this case look like they're running something like 100 kilohertz or somewhere in that area. And they're basically just, turn them off at 250 hertz intervals.
Okay. Are you saying there's a 100 kilovolt power supply, 100 kilohertz power supply, and now the power supply, because it runs at 100 kilohertz, could have a regulator time constant that's in the microseconds, and now for a certain number of microseconds on and microseconds off, I'm delivering 4 kilovolts to the magnetron, and by some completely separate circuit, filament voltage is continuously applied to the magnetron. Is that approximately what's happening, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's what this circuit looks like. I think, like you had nailed it in the beginning when you were saying that the tube probably doesn't need a tremendous amount of capacitance on the output, probably just something to keep the tube stable so that, it oscillates at the correct frequency. But, yeah, that's the way what it looks like there.
So, therefore, the real work is done by a 100 kilohertz switching regulator. In other words, the 110 volts comes in, gets rectified to 167 volts in theory of DC. The DC is running a pair of push-pull transistors as a switching regulator, switching at 100 KC, and now they are being pulse-width modulated. Is that approximately true?
Yeah, it looks like there's basically two PWM functions going on here at the same time. One at 100 kilohertz to regulate the 4 kV, and the secondary circuit looks like a control circuit that basically is like power adjusted. So in other words, if you're at 100% power, it's always on. And then what basically is happening is it looks like they're generating like a sawtooth waveform into a comparator here. And then basically what they're doing is by adjusting the level, they're pulse width modulating at like 250 hertz, turning that primary on and off. And it looks like the time constant of the 100 kilohertz circuit can regulate the 4kV in probably better than a millisecond or so. KC2QIQ.
Fantastic. You imagine that whole microwave oven, in my case, a fairly elaborate thing with all kinds of computer controls on it, is all sold for, I think it was $160. I forget the exact number I paid. I'll have to check on that one. That's a lot of stuff for the money. I'm amazed. Okay, Alex, KC2 Zulu Golf Zulu, KQLIW in the TechNet.
I just want to switch 4,000 volts to the pulse width modulation. What do they do there? And if they are not in the 4,000 volts in the pulse width modulation, then they must be changing the product. So they must have some sort of a toroid transfer. I think the best would have been exactly or QA. There's actually one AC cycles, and that's how the duty cycle is changing in the primary, and they very careful point, so you won't find the pulses or half pulses or some ugly signals there that might screw up the transformer. So pretty sure that your range is working with the duty cycle such a way that every second, every third, every fourth cycle is done. Back to you.
Yeah, I heard everything you said by listening on the inputs, Alex. You were only coming through the machine about half time. The signal was a little bit weak. What Glenn said is he looked at the schematic diagrams of some of the better microwave ovens, and he discovered that the power supply is not running at 60 cycles. It takes the raw 60-cycle input and rectifies it to DC immediately. Then that DC is running a high-voltage inverter, a pair of switching transistors running at the 100 kilohertz rate. They are making the 4 kilovolts, the 100 kilohertz rate switching transistors as an inverter. That goes into a toroid step-up transformer, gives you 4 kilovolts. And it's got a voltage regulator system on that, making the 4 kilovolts right. Now, that circuit is pulse width modulated at a 250 pulses per second rate. And so the net result is that if Glenn is right, when I look with my RF detector on my microwave oven, I'm going to see bursts of RF energy at a 250 kilohertz rate, and their duty cycle represents the average power the microwave tube is creating. Quite a bit more circuitry there than I expected. If you've got the schematic diagram in front of you right now, Raphael, of the beautiful article you talked about last week that was in Ham Radio Magazine, I figured out how it works, and it's pretty crafty. That rod going down the center of that bell housing is where all the action takes place. What's really happening here is you've got a toroid in the bottom of this bell housing, which has got a winding on it, a toroid ferrite transformer.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And as you feed voltage into that one winding of that toroid transformer, you're making a magnetic field that goes around the racetrack inside of the toroid. That's a completely closed system. As you know, in the case of a toroid, every time your piece of wire goes through the center of the donut represents one turn applied to the toroid. So in this housing, you've got this toroid in the bottom of this shielded housing, and you've got this metallic rod going up the center through the middle of that exciting toroid. When you want to measure your unknown toroid material, you slip it on top of the first toroid by also slipping it over that metallic rod. Then when you put the top of the bell housing on, you make it a completely closed circuit where there's a rod going down the center of both toroids, the known one with the exciting coil and the unknown one. And then the magnetic circuit is completed. I said magnetic circuit. Electronic circuit is created by the rod that goes through the center, touching the top of the housing, and then all of the rest of the housing around the outside constitutes one turn. Let me drop. The net result is that you have two toroids, one sitting on top of the other, with an airspace between them. You have a one-turn electronic circuit wired through both toroids. The rod going down the center and the conductivity of the shell, the brass shell around the outside, constitutes one single turn that goes through both toroids. So you could say the first toroid has a normal winding with a one-turn secondary. The one-turn secondary also goes through the second piece of ferrite material. And therefore, you're exciting the second piece of ferrite material with one turn from its primary, so to speak, which comes from the secondary of the other toroid. Very crafty circuit. And then by installing the bell on the end and not installing on the bell on the end, and with and without the unknown toroid ferrite material, you create a short and open and a loaded circuit. And by properly analyzing the inductance that you get in those three modes of operation, you end up knowing what is the inductance of your primary of your toroid, what is the inductance you'll get per turn of the secondary toroid, the unknown, what is the permeability of the second, and so on. Very crafty circuit. So at first, common sense would lead you to believe that the rod going down the center should be magnetic material. Absolutely not. Because that's at right angles to the magnetic field that flows through the racetrack of each toroid. It's only a conducting rod that counts. And you'd like it to have 0 ohms of resistance to make things simple. But by way of the short and open circuit, you find out about that all pretty fast. So now I think I understand the principle of operation now. K2KEY is the guy who brought this to our attention last week. This is the June...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
KC2QAQ with a curve.
And this is the June 77 issue of Ham Radio Magazine. Go ahead, Glenn.
Okay, envision this, Dick. If you have an inductor and a core, and you measure the inductance of a winding, and then you put another one-turn winding, and you short it out, what kind of inductance do you think you'd read on the first inductor, the first winding?
That's a complicated question, because if the toroid was perfect, one shorted turn of truly 0 ohms would make the inductance of the primary winding on the toroid go to zero, in theory. But in the real world, that one turn that you've added, because it's now down at the milliohm level of effectivity, what is its series resistance? What is the leakage reactance around it? There's a whole lot of other variables. You're going to get a drastic decrease in the inductance of the original toroid winding when you put in the shorter turn, but it's not going to go to absolute zero for at least two or three reasons. That's my first guess, Glenn. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's actually not reading the actual inductance of the permeability. It's reading the difference, which is kind of interesting. I've read through this article one time already, and I'm still not sure I completely understand it yet, but I'll get back to you when I fully get the picture of this. But it is a very interesting device, and it's frequency sensitive. So what they're really doing here is they're giving you permeability at higher frequency, and which apparently, according to this, has very little to do with the permeability at the USABO or the unbiased DC level inductance stick. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, for a bunch of reasons, he decided to run the circuit between 7 and 8 megacycles. And of the 10 materials he tested, material number 6 is the one where he expected to get a mu of 75 and he got a mu of 9. However, that material was supposed to be running at something like 100 kilohertz, and he is firing it up at 7 megacycles. So he was way outside of the design frequency range of that particular material, probably grain size, if you know what I mean. the fact that he got such a big deviation between measurement and prediction, so to speak, naive prediction, is somewhat understandable. He was using that material way out of the range. And as long as he's got the right kind of ferrite material in his primary coil, I see not much problem in operating it at a much lower frequency, as long as he doesn't run out of range of his measurements. So let me pass it over to Mel first for a quick comment on this before we go back to Glenn. We think we figured out how this thing works, Mel. And fairly nice circuit. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
And WS2N, I wanted to give a space report before it gets too late, Dick.
Yeah, we called you twice over the last hour or so, Paul. You may have gotten called away.
I did. That's why I'm just trying. Wonder if that's fine. If not, we'll go next week.
Okay, let me let Mel make a quick comment, and we'll go over to the space report. Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, before we delve into this in detail, Dick, because it's going to take a little bit of time to do a little bit more dissection, pick up Paul. He's been waiting patiently, over.
And we've been waiting for Paul. Paul, you got the floor. What's NASA doing these days?
I had my HT with me, but I was unable to get back. So I figured, well, let me wait. But now I look at the time. We're getting later. All right, Dick. Yeah, very good. I just wanted to mention a couple of things. One thing is the STS-133 discovery is going up Wednesday. There was a delay of a couple of days. They had a couple of leaks in fueling the orbiter, but that's been resolved. So on Wednesday, that will be going up. It's the final mission of Discovery, the 39th. You have one more mission going, I think, next February, and that will be the final shuttle mission. But that'll be going up, and they've got a lot of equipment that's going up to the space station, ammonia tanks and things like that. Also, the Leonardo multi-purpose module, that's been a unit that's gone up. It's as big as, the Columbus module that's up there. It takes up, like, most of the cargo hull of the shuttle. And that's gone up, and they attach it to the space station, and they'll utilize it the whole time that they're up there, and then they bring it back. Well, this being the end of the shuttle mission, this time they're going to bring it up there. It's going to permanently be mounted, so there'll be like an additional room up there. They call that the Leonardo permanent multi-purpose module. And they put the word permanent in there now. And that's the main piece of equipment they're bringing up, along with additional things that they...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I gotta watch the timeout. It's WS2N. They have a lot of different things on board that they're bringing up, but one interesting one I've been following is they call it the R2. It's the Robonaut 2. It's a humanoid robot. And this thing is... They had the Robonaut 1, which was initially being designed by NASA years ago. It started around 14 years ago. And then they stopped funding it maybe about, 5-6 years into it. But General Motors thought it was interesting. And they thought maybe they could use it for their equipment, building cars in the future. And they started developing the Robonaut 2 for their purpose with this robot. It's about the size of a person. Back in 2007, NASA said, hey, this is great. We've got to work on this ourselves. And they joined up with GM. And now they have it space ready to go up. What they're going to do is, it's actually inside this Leonardo permanent multi-purpose module that it's stacked along with all the other stuff. And they'll take it apart maybe a couple of months from now after it's attached and put it inside the Destiny module. Let me drop it. temporarily installed it into the Unity node and one of the other modules up there, and then eventually it will be working in the Destiny module. That's the U.S. Lab that's part of the International Space Station. And if you were to look at it, I mean, it has a head, two arms, a backpack, a torso. Doesn't have any legs yet. Depending how it works, it'll eventually bring a set of legs up for this thing. And you bring up R2 or Robonaut 2 on the internet, you could actually see what this thing looks like. Head and moves around, its arms, hands. In the future, they'll use it for, once this thing, you know, becomes functional, they'll upgrade software. They'll be able to use it outside the space station to do repairs and to assist spacewalkers, or maybe even send it out by itself to do work outside the space station. And depending on how that goes on the International Space Station, they'll be able to send it up by itself to maybe service satellites, like weather satellites or reconnaissance satellites, and send it out maybe to deep space missions. Maybe land on asteroids and be able to work on asteroids, maybe even comets. When they get ready for Mars programs, they can send it to Mars, maybe even to the moons of Mars and drop it. You know, you'll be able to have Robonaut 2 digging up soil on, let's say, one of the moons of Mars, or, you know, building infrastructure for future moon and Mars missions. I mean, it really looks like, you know, it's got a head and its arms. It looks like you could put somebody inside of it. It looks like a big spacesuit that's operating. And when they got a hold of it, NASA made some changes. They changed out things like the outside skin. They wanted to make it fireproof. And they changed the fabric and whatever it was made of. They put in different fans. The fans that were on board were very noisy. They don't like all these noisy pieces of equipment on board the space station, so they changed out the cooling fans inside this thing. It's got a lot of electronics, so it has fans inside. They wanted to go with, originally was designed by GM with AC, but they wanted to switch it over to a DC. They have a standard 28 volt DC on board the space station. Putting on there for RF purposes. Let me drop it again. This is WS2N. And, you know, how much does this thing weigh? It's a heavy thing on Earth, of course. But up on the space station, it don't weigh anything, but it's, mass-wise, anyway, it's 300 pounds on Earth. It's got a, you know, like a height of, again, it's a torso all the way up to the head, roughly a little over 3 feet, shoulder span, a couple of feet. It's got all kinds of processors on board there. It's like a super duper computer. It's got like 38 different processors. If you look at the head, you say, okay, there must be some kind of a brain in there. Look on the internet, you normally would say, okay, that's probably where all the electronics is, but that's not really true. That's where all the vision is. It's got four or five different cameras on board, including an infrared camera. You can see in 3D, you know, in stereo. If you look at it's got this backpack. What's the backpack? The backpack is the power system, you know, the whole power supply set up, being tapped off the space station. In future missions, when eventually it's autonomous, that backpack will consist of really not only a power system, but they'll have batteries on board. Right now, it don't have batteries. You look at the arms, how much it can lift. The arms can lift like about 20 pounds each. It does have five fingers, including thumbs. Drop it. Each finger pushing against the thumb. I remember reading about 5 pounds of force for each finger, so, I mean, actually be strong in a person, with the dexterity of a person. It's, I've seen it operate. It's pretty incredible. So I thought I'd bring that up. I have a couple of EVAs on board for that flight. One other thing I wanted to mention, you always ask about the servicing of the space station after the shuttle is gone. SpaceX, they call it SpaceX, is the company that's going to be in the United States resupplying the space station. Well, they have a module or a capsule that they're developing. It's called the Dragon. Really the Dragon capsule. And that will be going up this week, maybe another week, I think second week of November. They'll be launching that into space. They have the SpaceX has their own rocket that they launched. It's called the Falcon 9. They've tested that already. But this is the first time they're going to put this Dragon resupply vehicle into space. It's a test flight, so it'll be going into orbit couple hundred miles up, but only for about four orbits. It's the first flight of this vehicle. Drop it. They plan on making a couple of orbits, you know, like about a four-hour flight, bringing it back and landing it in the Pacific Ocean. But if this thing all checks out, they have a contract with NASA to resupply the space station with dozens of these flights. Now this thing is complex enough, this Dragon capsule is complex enough and designed eventually to switch over from a cargo vehicle to supplying people to and from the space station. And I saw the layout on the this capsule. You could fit up to seven astronauts on board. They have the seats all lined up, four in a row on top, second floor below it, three in a row, so you can put seven people on board. And that's pretty much it. They've got their own launch vehicle, like I said, called the Falcon 9, two-stage rocket, put it to orbit, could lift up to 50,000 pounds to low Earth orbit, maybe 5,000 pounds to geosynchronous orbit. So that's the latest, Dick, switching over to getting away from government to private. Funding, or probably actually a private business, resupplying the space station. That's it for the space report, Dick. Back to you, WS2N.
Well, if I understand correctly, this coming Wednesday, most likely STS-133 gets launched, and then sometime later, one more shuttle launch takes place, and then the whole shuttle program stops. And from there on, all maintenance, servicing, supply, and what have you is taking place either by SpaceX, and is SpaceX domestic or foreign, and how much history does SpaceX have in doing work like this with their Falcon 9 booster? Kind of curious about that call. Also, you mentioned how many pounds the SpaceX is capable of putting into geosynchronous orbit. Run that by again. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, I think it's roughly a 10-to-1 ratio. No, I think it put up a 50,000 pound payload, including the craft itself. So, resupplying the space station, you're going to bring up supplies similar to the Progress Russian spacecraft of about 6,000 pounds. But if you're going to put a spacecraft, let's say, into geosynchronous orbit, it would only be about 5,000-pound payload. So, that would be a completely different configuration. You wouldn't have this big capsule going up to geosynchronous orbit. What other question? There was another question in there, Dick, somewhere.
Yeah, is SpaceX a domestic company or foreign? And how much track record, how much history do they have up till now of heavy lift launching. Over to you, Paul.
They've been around a while. They've had one successful flight of the Falcon 9. I think that was back in the spring, May, maybe June. That was just, without their capsule on top. This is going to be the first one with the capsule on top. And it was started by the guy that does PayPal. I don't remember his name, but he's the money guy behind that. There's a lot of different private companies that were vying for this thing. The guy Bigelow, he was pushing for it. Didn't work out for him. Bigelow Aerospace. He's got some kind of contract, auxiliary contract, but one that really won out was SpaceX Group. They got a couple of $1 billion contract with NASA. So there's quite a few private companies involved with different variations of space travel. But this is the main one for resupplying the space station with eventually people.
Interesting. So I guess the combination of the Soviet supply as well as the SpaceX supply, I think you're saying that the people, material, and replenishment of consumables, all of that's going to go on at approximately the same rate it has been up till now. I have the impression that the SpaceX Falcon 9 combination is an unmanned vehicle. So is that a manned or an unmanned vehicle? Is it always an unmanned vehicle, is my question. Can it be a manned vehicle? And at the rate we're going, what's your best guess as to the future history of the International Space Station? Are we going to use it for 2 more years or 10 more years? What's your guess, Paul? Go ahead.
Okay, it's just starting to pass the 10-year mark now. Originally designed for 15 years, but of course that's already been pushed out to 25, so at least 10 years down the road, my guess is way more than that. The supplying it, you've got Japan. They've already built and blown, I think it's HB2 cargo vehicle. Hasn't docked yet with the space station. That'll be a resupply vehicle. You've got the ATV every 6 or 8 months, automatic transfer vehicle by the European Space Agency. That's a big supply vehicle. It does about 3 times more than what we're talking about here. So you have that, and you have the SpaceX. Actually, SpaceX is the name of the company. The launching vehicle, the Falcon 9, is a rocket, 2-stage, all liquid fuel. Both of them are liquid fuel. On top of that stack, you have the Dragon. It goes the Dragon capsule. And this Dragon capsule is the equivalent of the Progress capsule. That will be the cargo resupply vehicle. But eventually, and already designed for capability of bringing astronauts up to a total of 7, 4 on the first deck and then 3 on the bottom deck inside the Dragon capsule. It comes back sort of like an Apollo craft with three chutes on it. You'll see it. It'll be landing, I guess, the 18th of November in the Pacific near California.
Will you to TTG?
Go ahead, TTG.
Yeah, morning, Dick. I have a question for WS2N. If we just rate from top to bottom the lift capabilities of each of the launch vehicles, the European Space Agency vehicle, the SpaceX vehicle, the Progress, the Japanese vehicle, anything else I missed. From top to bottom, how are they ranked, and what are we talking about?
I would put Progress and SpaceX, they would be about equal, around 6,000 pounds. The only, let's see, then you have the, was the HB2A. Well, the Japanese one, I think, is H2 or HB2. I forget the designation that they use. And I think that's a little bit more. And then you go up to the ATV, about three times the amount of the Progress. Also, this one here, the Dragon Capital. So, on the bottom of the list, you have the Dragon and Progress. Then you go up to the Japanese one, and then up to the ATV. And the only difference is the ATV have maximum return flights, usually around 6 to 8 months, where these, you like, they're already signed up for like 20 flights for cargo alone. So you're going to have more of these. You have many more progress, you know, every 3 months they're going up. So in the long run, I think they're about the same, because you have more flights with smaller vehicles. Back to you.
How do they compare to the shuttles lift?
Payload on the shuttle is, well, you don't use the shuttle strictly as a, you know, you bring up 30,000, 40,000 pounds, you know, a payload on a regular basis. You know, these are all these different modules that they brought up, you know, some 30, 40, 50,000 pound modules that the shuttle has brought up. So not one flight has been just strictly, you know, food, oxygen, clothes, you know, standard equipment that the, you know, that the space station needs. The shuttle is like a truck that brings up these gigantic modules. You know, they were always like, what, 14, 15 feet in diameter, always about 20, 21 feet long, like this multi-purpose Leonardo permanent module they're bringing up. It's a big thing, you know, another gigantic room. So, I don't know. If you were to use this space shuttle, it's got to be, what, 10 times? 10 times the weight, I guess. Thank you.
So none of these new launch vehicles or older ones will have the heavy lift that the shuttle has to be able to add these enormous modules to the space station, or frankly anywhere else. So how are we going to either A, add more modules, or B, think about, you know, dropping things onto the moon if we don't have a heavy lift capability, I guess is my question.
Yeah, and related to that, Paul, each shuttle mission, after it delivered its payload to the International Space Station, would do some boosting. I mean, the International Space Station is always slowly decaying in orbit, and the shuttle would do quite a bit of boosting on each mission. Who's going to do the boosting in the future? Over to you, Paul.
Well, all the Progress ships have that capability. They don't use Soyuz for that, although they could. Soyuz, they use for returning astronauts and cosmonauts. Boosting will be done by all these cargo vehicles. I haven't heard anything about this Dragon capsule yet, but I imagine that that will fill the bill. One of the things that they do is they also refuel the space station. A lot of people don't realize the space station has thrusters on board, which could itself not only reorient itself in space, but could boost its orbit. So those capabilities are still there. Shuttle was the main supplier of doing that. Anytime they went up there, it was always about 12, 14 miles high that they would leave the space station before they left.
The International Space Station, your guess is 15 or 20 more years. From what I'm hearing, because of the heavy lift capability that the shuttle used to have, it's no longer there. I suspect that not a great deal more construction of the International Space Station is going to take place. You're going to give me a confirmation on that, Paul, that the construction is essentially completed. And there was a troublesome rotary joint on one the solar cell panels at one time. Has that problem been essentially cured, to your knowledge? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, the rotary joints that spin, you know, when you look at the space station, you see these big four panels sticking out, four sets of panels, and they do rotate as they go around the Earth. They face their, they try to face the sun, you know, straight on as much as possible. That was fixed a couple of flights ago. SDS-130 was the last real construction flight. That was a couple of, this year, that was the cupola that they bought up, that where they had six trapezoidal windows all connected to one another and mounted to one of the nodes, the Harmony node, and they could look out down at Earth, look at all the different flights that are coming and going from the space station. There's one octagonal mirror or window right in the middle. That was the end of the actual construction, but they added this one at the very end, the Leonardo module. But they, you know, inside this module, this Leonardo science module, they always had these racks filled with science equipment, and they'd bring it up, and it would remain during the course of the shuttle flight. In a couple of weeks, they'd bring it back. Now, instead of doing that, they're just going to leave that permanently. So, actually, now this becomes the last installation. Let me drop it. Last permanent installation of anything that's going up. Russians have a few things that they, small things they want to bring up, attached to their part of the space station. They might do that in the future. But essentially, it's complete. If they need to add something or want to add something, will rely on the Proton rocket from Russia to do that. They would bring it up independently. Right now, there's no plans of doing anything like that, so you really have a completed space station, really, as of this flight. Back to you, Dick.
Any idea what kind of science experiments are about to take place or have taken place on the International Space Station? Are there any big plans that we've heard about as to what experiments are about to be run up?
Well, there's hundreds of them that we have. I mean, this mission alone. If you go to the NASA website and you download the press kit, I think it's 10 or 15 meg, probably the equivalent of 104 pages of everything to do with this particular flight, like they do for every flight. And you read the science section, you know, all the stuff that they're bringing up just for all these different experiments. It's even more than I can read. It's page after page of things like that. So, I mean, there's hundreds of it's been going on since the beginning. More so now that you have a permanent six-man crew, because maintenance of the space station takes about three people, and the other three people are doing real-time science.
Sounds good, Paul. Thank you. What an endeavor. And I guess now this is the majority of manned missions on the International Space Station. It appears as though we're not going to the moon anytime soon. You guys have heard me say a lot of times, I don't think we're going to Mars in any reasonable length of time. So therefore, the manned missions are space station, or I guess some of the developing nations deciding to put men in space. Although, one last question on that, Paul. Do you know of any of the developing nations who are developing a space capability? Do they have any intentions of putting any men in space in orbit other than sending them to the space station, International Space Station? WS2N, K2LIW.
The only country besides Russia and the United States that's ever put anybody into space is China. They were up to three flights. They put one guy up by himself, and then they've had two 2020 to have a manned mission to the moon. We were supposed to be landing there 2018, 2 years before that. That ain't going to happen, from what I say, unless these private companies, get involved. You know, you've got everybody, Virgin Galactic doing suborbital flights, SpaceX doing the resupplying. You've got Orbital Science Corporation involved with small rockets and satellites, scale composites, and they're involved with Virgin Galactic. Dozens of them. There's a Planetary Society. They're involved with interstellar fight with the solar sails, Bigelow. They lost out to this, but they have some other kind of contract with NASA. You know, Bigelow Aerospace. You have a couple of other ones that had planned, still plans of, landing a craft that will go to the moon and actually land on the moon.
Welcome to
the Mobile
Amateur Radio
Club
for
Think Active. Paul, if the Chinese are intending to put a man on the moon in the year 2020, do they say what the goal is? What's their motive for doing that? Paul, go ahead.
I think it's, it's like anything else. Any country, the idea of putting people up into space for themselves was to show that they could do it. And they want to go it alone. That's the hard part, you know. I mean, if we were to do it again, I really see, when I say we, the government of the United States, I can see partnership with Russia and European Space Agency for future moon and Mars missions, no problem. China wants to do it alone. 2020, I don't think so. I mean, you ask what their plans were, that was their plan. I mean, they also have a plan for their own space station by, before that, I think 2015. I don't think so, but, they want to go it alone. They're going down the wrong road, actually.
Very fine, Paul. Thank you for that information. So this coming Wednesday, do you happen to know what time of day the launch is likely to take place, Paul?
I didn't look that up. It's been changed. I'll have to look that one up again, Dick. Definitely on the NASA site. But I know it's not a night flight. The night flights are gone.
Understand. Okay, we've gone beyond the bewitching hour. We're over 4 hours into the TechNet. You guys have listened to TechNet number 1321 of the series that began 28 and a fraction years ago, way back in 1982. I know that John would like to hear a little bit more about my theory of how an antenna radiates. I'm still developing that. I think that'll wait until next week, John. And other than that, be kind to each other, and Mel and I and the crew will be back next week. And Mel, over to you for any other comments you'd like to make. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. I guess we'll discuss permeability and its device, which is very interesting. Every time I look at the magazine article on it, it's fascinating. It's got a couple ideas and a couple of questions that I'd like to run out to the next. So just next week will be maybe we can do it a little earlier, Dick. So with that, I guess we'll close it up for tonight. Thank all those who join us, email us, and all. Have a great week.